It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, as schools around the state decide whether to begin classes online, in person, or a combination of the two, we'll talk to the Deputy State Superintendent of Public Instruction about the state's role in making sure the school year begins safely and productively. Right now, it's the first Monday of the month, which means it's time for another edition of Mondays with Mike. WPR Director Mike Crane stops by each month, either here on Central Time, on The Morning Show, or on The Larry Mueller Show, to talk about what's happening on and off the air. This month, we're going to talk about the end of production for two national programs, a storytelling initiative for military members and their families, a new Ideas Network station about to go online, and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about what we do here at WPR? Do you have a show or type of show you'd like to hear on WPR? Something you'd like to hear less of or maybe at a different time? Maybe a technical question about WPR.org or the WPR app. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Mike, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here doing kind of the new normal where we're not where I would be used to be with you, Rob, not sitting in the studio with you, but instead at my home office.
We'll make the best of it, even though we can't actually see each other. That's right.
Yep.
Well, it's in addition to the pandemic going on, we've got an election season going on. Mike, let's talk about some political programming here on the Ideas Network. We've had interviews, of course, on Central Time and the Morning Show with candidates. What else do we have going on, Mike, for this, especially this August primary and beyond?
Yeah, there are a couple of primaries around the state. La Crosse regional manager and host of the regional program Newsmakers, Ezra Wall, is moderating two primary debates for Wisconsin's 3rd congressional district. And we had the Republican debate last Friday between Jesse Eben and Derek Van Orden, and that was Friday on stations in the Southwest, Western, and Central regions. And this Thursday at 10 a.m., Democrats Ron Kind and Mark Newman will be facing off. And both debates will be archived at WPR.org/politics.
And we'll have lots of our interviews with the primary candidates at that same place and more as the general election approaches. Hey, Mike, one big deal that I definitely want to make sure we don't miss talking about this time around, this partnership now that we at WPR have with StoryCorps and this Military Voices initiative we've got going on. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Many people would know StoryCorps, probably mostly listening to our other network, the News and Music Network, or because it's just been so popular within public radio for years. And what they do is they record the real voices and interviews of everyday people and then archive them in the Library of Congress, which is remarkable. And they're specifically focused right now on their Military Voices initiative, looking for stories of veterans, service members, and military families, not just the veterans themselves, because as we know, the whole family is in if someone is in the military. And so the idea is to share their experiences in their own words and for, in terms of the opportunity we get as civilians to understand more clearly the complex realities of veterans service and sacrifice. So what's going on, Rob, is they're coming to Wisconsin virtually and seeking representations from all branches and eras of experience with the military, and there's a special focus on people from underrepresented and marginalized populations in our state, including women, Black, Latinx, Native American, Hmong, and Lao, and LGBTQ veterans, among others. And so that's a really exciting opportunity, and some of that will end up airing either on WPR or on stations nationwide, and all of it will be archived in the Library of Congress to continue telling the stories of our nation.
And I wanted to bring that up in part because people listening right now, if they're in that category, a military member or family, or they know somebody, we want to spread the word, right?
Absolutely. So usually this goes very fast, but I think there should still be some slots to reserve a recording time at storycorps.org/military. And I'll repeat that again in a second. Because you can also call a phone number, which is 800 850 4406. So again, it's storycorps.org/military. And StoryCorps is spelled StoryCorps. And the number one more time is 800-850-4406. Really hope people will participate. I think it'll be great.
Talking to WPR Director Mike Crane. It's Mondays with Mike, talking about what's going on the air and behind the scenes here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Wanda is with us in Orfordville. Wanda, hello.
Hello. I welcome the chance to say what I have to say. Whatever happened to old-time radio?
Sure. Thank you, Wanda, for the question. This was something that, upon reflection, we should have been talking about more earlier. But we've been trying to work for quite a long time in removing from the catalog of old-time radio dramas that we played on the air programs that had outdated attitudes or inappropriate characterization of people. And in the midst of all of the news this summer flowing from the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests and all the rest, we took a hard look at it and decided that it was time for us to let it go. With real regret from this one standpoint, which is we know that there are people like you, Wanda, who really loved it. And among the problems that I think maybe we could have explained better is that it's not simply that there isn't anything offensive that is said in an old radio drama, but a lot of our Black and people of color, Indigenous people, have let us know for years that they also were looking for content on WPR to include representation of them in real life. And you certainly can find exceptions, but for the most part, what you find in a lot of the old dramas, and you see this on TV shows from the same era, is that there aren't a lot of people of color. They very rarely have a prominent authoritative role or are the writers of the stories, or the roles for women are often very stereotyped and so on. And so we just felt like the time had really come. It was probably overdue. And I know that hurt some listeners, and it was very difficult for our host, Norman, as well, because he and listeners have put so much heart into it, as well as some of the other people surrounding Norman in helping to put on that show. So that's what's going on with it, Wanda. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call, Wanda, at 800-642-1234. It's a good entry point, Mike, into some other changes we're seeing from the national shows changing production. I think you talked about this last time when you were on the morning show, but remind us of a couple of the changes that we're hearing from some of our national partners.
Sure, and we're very close to being ready to announce some new schedule things that resulted from this national set of changes. We're not quite there yet. We're still working on it. But Only a Game, which was a production out of WBUR in Boston, is ending production in just a few weeks. And also from that station in Boston, WBUR, On Point, which has been 2 hours a day here on the Ideas Network, 9 to 11, they're moving to a one-hour schedule. And Meghna Chakrabarty, who's a great host, will be hosting all 5 days. And David Folkenflik will go back to full-time reporting with NPR as their media correspondent. So that's the sort of daytime schedule stuff. And then in the evening, Live From Here, which was the replacement show for A Prairie Home Companion, has decided that they're ending production as well. And obviously a lot of this is tied into fiscal difficulties that some stations have faced as a result of COVID-19. But also you can tell that they're trying to use the occasion of those difficulties to rethink things. And that's why On Point decided to move to a one-hour program. And so we're figuring all that out in terms of what it means for the Ideas Network, and we'll let you know soon.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Lori is with us in Hales Corners. Lori, hi.
Hi, yes. I just read an article that Amazon plastics, I mean, I think I saw this online, Amazon plastics are not all recyclable. And I think they're very well-intentioned. I'm hoping that we can cover that and understand that they're making an effort to reduce the disposable aspects of all that packaging. And another factor, and maybe even a different story, would be we are relying very much on delivery and packaging materials and non-recyclable things, and it bothers me. I wonder if we can head in a new direction and get some technology going and another way of, maybe we have to go back to the horse and carriage. What do you think? I don't know.
Lori, thanks a lot for the call. And that sounds like a suggestion for either an interview segment on one of our Ideas Network shows or something for the news department, Mike. And with that, we're always looking for feedback, not necessarily about which particular programs we should air, but there are ways people can reach out and make program suggestions to the existing shows.
That's right. And, you know, years ago on the radio here, we often said that the Ideas Network was talk about issues that matter to you. And that's what Lori has just talked about, an issue that matters to her, which is terrific. And we do. We want to know what should we cover, what should we talk about, because it's important to you, and that's our effort all the time. The Ideas Network is a wonderful clearinghouse of ideas that all of us have as citizens or residents of Wisconsin.
Thanks for that call. And anyone, if you ever have ideas for programs here at WPR, a great clearinghouse, a great way to reach out to us is our audience services department. You can call them at 800-747-7444. That's 800-747-7444. Or email listener@WPR.org. And they make sure messages go where they need to go. It's the August edition of Mondays with Mike with Wisconsin Public Radio Director Mike Crane. And you can join in at a different number, 800-642-1234. Do you have some feedback for us about what you're hearing or not hearing on WPR? Any particular show or type of show you want WPR to carry? Praise, criticism, question, comment. That's what we're here for right now. 800-642-1234 is the number. Email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's the August edition of Mondays with Mike. WPR Director Mike Crane is here to bring us up to speed on WPR programming and operations. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to hear more of, less of? Do you have a question just out of curiosity about how we do and why we do what we do? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Harry is with us in Soldiers Grove. Harry, hi.
I want to address what I'm thinking of, what you could call the binary nature of a lot of the interview programs. You have two people, usually on ideological, they're polar opposites, and then they repeat their stuff over and over again. And I was curious about having a third person there to bridge that ideological gap and be more substantive in the answers rather than the boilerplate that we get from one side or the other, which also reflects another thing about, full disclosure, which is the weak cousin of due diligence, and letting the listeners know what the affiliations of the people are, and to remind the people during the program that that's going on, because I think that's an important point. And the nature of the questions themselves often seem to be multiple choice questions rather than essay questions. I know it's a radio format and time is limited, but nevertheless, it would be, I think, important to drive interviews to information and substance rather than ideological points of view.
Thanks a lot for that call, Harry. I want to bring in another caller, Mike, on a similar topic before I throw this to you. Nancy with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hello.
Hello to you. I'm calling for the fifth or sixth time at least to ask you to please bring back the Friday morning 8 o'clock program that was on for decades and decades, which consisted of two people, one from each prominent political party, discussing the week's events. This is the year of a very important, the most important national election probably ever. And yet you are refusing to bring back that program. On Friday mornings now at that time, I have noticed that Kate has something directed toward children. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you're trying to grow your own subsequent dynasties of people who are will be Wisconsin Public Radio listeners.
Nancy, but, thanks a lot for the call. So, Mike, two different views on the sort of point-counterpoint Republican-Democrat conversation there from those two callers.
Sure. And there's so many things contained in that. First, to Harry's point about how some of our guests will come with talking points. My worry, Harry, would be that a third voice might simply mean three sets of talking points as opposed to really doing what you'd like it to do, which I'd say we all would like our shows to do, which is to try to illuminate solutions from all different corners and ways that we can solve the problems of our states through dialogue. And so that is a challenge, but something that I know our producers do think about, and sometimes they probably could act on that more to bring on a third guest or something like that. And as for reminding people of affiliations, I think that's just good radio practice. And so to the extent that that might be a good reminder to our staff to do that, that's good. Because among other things, I know I tune in the radio whenever I tune in, and I might not have any idea who the person is without the host reminding us who they are. And so that's definitely a good idea. And as to Nancy's comments about, we call it the week in review, mm-hmm. What we were finding was that it was getting harder and harder to book, to get the guests to sign up, and was consuming a ton of time from our producers who were trying to do so many things. And so with a previous host, we suspended doing that. And actually in the political season, that's even harder because many of the people we might bring on are actually involved in the politics, and it would bring into question some of the equal time provisions that we have to keep an eye on, and so on. So we watch for that. And I have to say, Nancy, you may have called five or six times, but you're not the only one. And I know that our producers are aware of the interest, and they've been talking about whether there's a way they can pull it off. And so we haven't forgotten, even though I wouldn't call it as you did, that we've refused to do it. I understand how it may seem that way. And then last, just a I loved the add-on comment Nancy made about our children's programs, 1 hour on Fridays on the morning show. That's been a lot of fun. It was an idea to do that because a lot of kids are now home, not going to school in the traditional way, and that this was a way to engage them with the radio and their parents and so on, and it's been a lot of fun to do it.
Thanks for those calls. We're talking to Mike Crane, director of Wisconsin Public Radio, taking your calls with questions and comments and suggestions. Back to your calls now. Richard is with us in Antigo. Richard, hi.
Hi, Mike. My family has been involved with the Republican Party for as far back as I can remember, all the way back before Reagan. And my uncle always gets letters and cards thanking him for all his donations. I got a signed letter from Nancy and Ronald Reagan. And I can't get my head around why some people vote exactly according to party lines rather than voting for a candidate, which I do myself, because I can't stand, following one set of rules, and that's it. Nobody wants to do anything else than just follow the party line. And maybe you could have somebody on that or ask questions, why do they do that? And is there a reason to it?
Richard, thanks a lot for the call. And we've definitely had a lot of conversations about party affiliation and what motivates people to vote for him. It's an interesting topic, Mike.
It really is. And I've heard, sort of behind the scenes discussion about that, because some people feel like party line's the only way to go. And in some places, as you know, you're like for the primaries, you have to choose a party in our state. Other states, you can cross the lines any which way. And that is kind of a small example of how different places come up with a different idea about what to do for that. But talking about the politics of our state and our nation, that's right in our wheelhouse, mm-hmm. Richard. So we'll keep doing it.
Thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. Hey, Mike, one piece of news that kind of snuck up on me that I don't want to miss. Big news for our listeners in southern Wisconsin, a new Ideas Network transmitter coming online in the not too distant future. What's going on?
Oh, that's right. You know, in Janesville and that area, basically for the Ideas Network, the station you can get is WHA AM. And that goes to very low power at night, and it can be a little hard to receive. So we've been busy trying to add translators, which are really just small transmitters around the state to improve reception for people. And this will be for Janesville. It's our 38th station, Rob. And we are planning for it to be on the air by the end of September. And so the folks in Rock County should get a better Ideas Network signal at that time.
That is fantastic news. I have had, you know, I drive over the years, I've driven that way a lot. And a couple times, if I hit it just right, I can keep WHA AM almost to Chicago. And then sometimes, yeah, especially at night, it's gone before I get to Janesville. So that is really good news. Well, Mike, tease something here. What are you looking forward to over the next month or so before the next Mondays with Mike?
You know, we're just doing so many great conversations and a lot of in-depth reports. The issues of our time, whether it's Black Lives Matter or COVID-19 or, boy, all of the election coverage and so on, it's going to be in this sense of covering news, a great time to cover news, whether the news is great or not. And so I look forward to listening a lot alongside our listeners.
Well, thanks to all of our callers today. And Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to almost see you.
Someday. Mike Crane is the director of Wisconsin Public Radio. He joins us on the Ideas Network once a month, either here on Central Time, on the morning show, or on the Larry Mueller Show to talk about WPR programming and operations. He'll be on next on September 14th with Larry Mueller. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a top official at the state's Department of Public Instruction about the beginnings of the upcoming school year amid the ongoing pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up every other month, farmers in Crawford and Vernon counties are meeting to talk about what they can do to keep their local watershed clean. We'll talk to two members of the group about what they've learned so far. First, for students and teachers around Wisconsin, summer vacation is winding down, then it's time to hit the books. But what the upcoming school year is going to look like remains a mystery in some ways. Some schools have opted to begin instruction completely online. Others are planning to return to in-person learning 5 days a week. Some are proceeding with plans for a mix of virtual and in-person classes. Some schools have yet to announce their plans. Beyond that are questions related to wearing masks, what happens when a student or teacher tests positive for COVID-19, busing, kids with special needs, and a lot more. The State Department of Public Instruction released guidance to schools a few weeks ago. Mike Thompson is Deputy State Superintendent of Public Instruction. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, big picture from your perspective, Mike, are schools around the state feeling generally ready for this school year, or is there a lot still up in the air?
Well, I think I got to answer that question to say I think they're ready, and yes, still a lot is up in the air. So yes to both of those
little
questions.
Of both.
Schools have been planning for the reopening every day of the week since schools closed. But with the shifting nature of the virus, they know their plans need to be fluid.
We've seen some big teachers unions around the state and the five biggest cities around the state calling on the governor to order a virtual start to the school year. Evers said he believes schools can reopen safely. He's leaving it up on a district-to-district basis. Is there talk at DPI of some kind of guidance for all schools to go virtual, at least at the beginning of the school year?
Well, we don't quite frankly, we don't have the authority to direct what schools do. And so we are really supporting districts in the choice they make. And those are the three choices, as you know, districts are planning for, whether to go all virtual, whether to do a hybrid model, or whether to go person to person. And it varies by region of the state, and it varies by context of a school district. And they work closely with their local health jurisdiction, whether that be the county or a city jurisdiction, on what's the best decision for them and their context for opening their schools.
Let's get into some of the guidance you offered, and let's take it one step at a time here. First of all, for schools opening all or mostly in person, in these new guidelines and the new guidance from DPI, or newish at this point, what are some of the key ways that you want schools to stay safe as they reopen in person?
Yeah, that's the big key, Rob, about how do you maintain it, making that environment as safe as possible, and how do you mitigate those risk factors. And that's by putting in place protocols around social distancing, making sure children understand all the things we've been learning over the last several months about keeping yourself, keeping your hands clean, washing your hands frequently, keeping them away from your face, and all the issues around protocols in place. If someone does not feel well, or someone does show the symptoms of the virus, how do you isolate that person and make sure that you can minimize the contact with others? And then another factor is, how do we make sure that the environment kids are coming into is clean and is sanitized and then disinfected? And those are all the factors that they put in place. And schools that are deciding to open up for all kids coming back feel they can mitigate those factors, mitigate those health risks, and open in the safest way possible.
Some of the steps that schools will take are not free. They cost money. Do you see enough money out there and maybe enough support from the federal or state governments for schools to be able to do this effectively?
I would say the factors that districts are going to have to deploy to make sure their schools are as safe as possible, and the cost of those, are a concern to school districts. Now, I can tell you school districts will try to absorb those costs because the safety of kids is their number one concern. But certainly the finances of this are a concern to school districts. This is not without additional costs that districts will have to incur.
In the guidance, is there advice for schools when they see COVID-19 tests coming back positive in the school for when they should rethink in person?
Yeah, I think there's some information around the guidance around those issues and how to make sure that, and it's a partnership with, parents about sending their kids when they're not feeling good and paying attention to kids' temperatures and making sure when kids aren't feeling good, they stay home. And if they do come to school and they show symptoms of not feeling well or get a fever, we isolate them. So there's some guidance around those pieces as well. Also, this guidance is being continually updated, and our State Department of Health, along with local departments of health, continue to provide more up-to-date resources around the risk mitigation factors that they can deploy, the new science of what we're learning about the disease and how it spreads. So it's a constantly changing situation that we're all kind of trying to stay abreast of, but it's a partnership between, so this really is a partnership between, the health of kids and the health departments that we have, and then the educational expertise that our schools bring.
Talking to Mike Thompson, Deputy State Superintendent of Public Instruction here in Wisconsin, talking about guidance for schools around the state as they reopen during the pandemic, whether they're going all in person, all virtual, or somewhere in between. Let's go to the opposite extreme now, Mike. Schools that are at least starting the school year all virtual. So there you've got the protection from COVID-19, but there the concerns are about, are kids learning? Are they getting equal opportunities to learn? What are some of the key pieces of advice you've been sharing with districts?
Yeah, the key piece is we all have learned a lot about when you all have to go virtual from the school closure that happened in March. And we learned that there are some kids that didn't have access to the internet, more so than we thought maybe it was evident before, and didn't have access to computers or couldn't afford the internet even if it was available. So those create inequities about kids' opportunities to access education. Districts have been working hard through the summer to plan to reduce those inequities. I think most districts would tell you, most people would tell you, we all want kids back in that building. We are able to provide better service for kids face-to-face in what we call our bricks and mortar environment than we can online. But because of the pandemic and that we have to go virtual for their safety concerns, we need to be able to make sure that all kids have that access to the internet, have access to educational resources, and they've been planning around those pieces, and it will be certainly a better environment than for online learning than it was when they left for most school districts in the spring.
One of the biggest concerns when schools went virtual, as you mentioned, in the spring, was students with individualized educational plans, kids who have some kind of requirements for extra help, say, or different sorts of things in the school environment, the concern that they would slip through the cracks with online education. What are you telling schools to do to make sure that doesn't happen now in the fall?
Yeah. Well. First of all, all our kids with challenges, we have to make sure that their needs are met, including our kids that are identified with special needs. And there are some safeguards and protections through the federal and state law for their needs. But specifically, you have to plan around meeting those needs, and they're unique. And some districts are looking at different ways. They'll bring sometimes those kids in smaller settings into the building in smaller numbers to get that one-on-one contact. So there are different ways that they're trying to meet their needs. This, again, is really a cooperation with parents on their IEPs or individualized instructional plans that they work together to make sure those kids, like as you mentioned, do not slip through the cracks. In fact, those are the kids that we have to actually lift up and pay attention to, because they're arguably they're the ones who could suffer the most when their education is disrupted the way this pandemic has disrupted education.
How about schools that are going with a hybrid approach? Some in person, but ways to minimize the number of students, say, in the school at a time, with some virtual learning alongside that. Now, this is kind of uncharted ground, I think, for a lot of schools. What are you suggesting to them?
Well, districts are doing the hybrid model for various reasons. One, to reduce the number of kids in a building at one time, so they'll bring in different groups of kids at different times. Or they might decide, some would call even a hybrid model, where they bring the elementary kids in face-to-face and spread them out in their buildings, and then the kids that are more can take more advantage of online learning, maybe our middle and high school kids in that environment. So the key with that is that those type of learning environments provide the best opportunity possible for kids to learn. And so when you can combine those two models together in this pandemic, it could be quite effective. And districts have been working through that. And working through that means, do we have the right instructional materials to deliver instruction this way? And are teachers appropriately trained to deliver instructions in this type of instructional design? And that comes with training that districts are doing. That comes with joint planning. And those are parts of the instructional design, not only what they're doing for kids, but what they're trying to do for staff to be prepared to teach kids in these different types of environments.
Did you include guidance on things like the extracurriculars? I know there's a lot of talk about fall sports, some conferences saying there will be no fall sports, others coming up with different plans. So for the sports and other clubs and groups, the stuff outside of the classroom itself.
Yeah, this guy does touch on different things that go on in that school environment. But I do know that the WIAA and other organizations have worked towards how to make youth sports as safe as possible if you're going to conduct those activities. So there is guidance out there around how to do those as safe as possible. They're all part of the school environment. They're all part of bringing kids in that school environment. And so the health factors and the protocols that are put into place, what I mentioned before about social distancing and proper protocols of hygiene, are all in place for those activities as well, if the school districts choose to conduct those activities.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for the time.
That's Mike Thompson, Deputy State Superintendent of Public Instruction. We talked with him about Wisconsin schools as they get ready for the start of the upcoming school year. The DPI has guidelines for in-person and for virtual learning during the pandemic. Coming up, we'll hear about a group of farmers in southwestern Wisconsin who meet regularly to swap ideas and to protect their local waterways. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear from the creators of a small publishing company working to highlight underrepresented voices in the comics world. First, the Driftless region of Wisconsin is well known for its picturesque farms and its rivers and streams. A group of farmers in Crawford and Vernon counties has been meeting regularly to talk about how to improve their operations and protect those local waterways. The Tainter Creek Farmer-Led Watershed Council, part of the Valley Stewardship Network, has been bringing farmers together to swap ideas about maintaining water quality and giving younger farmers access to the knowledge of those who've been working in the area for generations. Danny Heisler-Woodle is the Regenerative Agriculture Outreach Coordinator for the Valley Stewardship Network based in Viroqua. Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rob, for having us.
And Barrett Froyland is a farmer who's been involved with the council since it got started in 2016. Barrett, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Barrett, you've been involved, I understand, with the group since its beginning. How did it get started?
A bunch of leaders from our area were contacted from Valley Stewardship Network, the local Land and Water Conservation Department, and some NRCS folks. And just wanted to see if there was any interest in starting a watershed council. So we had kind of the first couple of meetings, not really knowing what it was supposed to be about. But we kind of slowly grew it, and it was slowly explained to us through that. It also helped that in 2016 there was also a pretty significant rainfall event that happened in our watershed, 10 inches in probably less than a few hours. So everything was, all the timing was just right, and we kind of kept building on from there.
Danny, can you talk about the importance of having farmers involved in, you know, making these decisions and making these plans when it comes to preserving water quality?
Absolutely. So, I mean, as we know, water and water quality are critical for successful livestock and crop production. So really being at the forefront and being able to recognize the practices that farmers put into effect and being able to see the effects of what they're doing, they've made excellent stewards of kind of this program and sharing their knowledge and sharing any potential changes and being able to kind of showcase that throughout the other watersheds and the knowledge that they have.
And Barrett, Danny mentioned the word steward there. Do you think of yourself as a farmer, as a steward of, well, the soil, of course, and the water in your area?
Absolutely. We're just trying to protect what we have. We've heard of some horror stories going the other way, and I think everybody in our watershed and really most farmers view ourselves as stewards of the land. If we don't have that, we really don't have any way to move forward.
And Danny, this is organized around a watershed, not along, you know, county or town or whatever boundaries. Why is that important?
Right. So the watershed, our specific watershed, the Tainter Creek, it feeds into the Kickapoo, and we recognize that we're, you know, at the forefront of being able to make changes and affect the water quality all the way down, right? And as the waters continue to feed out, so really realizing that this is kind of the ground level, and any encouragement of regenerative practices and changes that happen here will continue to have compound effects as the water continues to move south all the way to the Gulf. So, you know, farmers here have really, really grasped that concept and appreciate that they're making a change. And so it's really kind of the real grassroots efforts right here in the Tainter Creek.
We're talking about the Tainter Creek Farmer-Led Watershed Council in southwestern Wisconsin. Danny Heisler-Woodle and Barrett Froyland are with us. So, Barrett, this involves meetings, as I understand it, every couple months, often on somebody's farm. Can you take us into one of these meetings? What is it like?
Really, it's pretty informal. Just having getting a group of guys together. We've had as few as three people show up, but lately we've been having really good turnouts. Usually, if it's on somebody's farm, we'll have a kind of a farm walkover just to see what you're trying. If they're trying some cover crops or trying some different pasturing techniques. Just in taking a look at their operation and kind of getting everybody some ideas and thinking of what they can take back to their own farm. And then kind of from there, there's usually a little bit of business or discussion of some meetings that we might be holding in the future. Of course, that's changed a little bit this year. But for the most part, it's just kind of a very open conversation amongst landowners on what they're trying and what's worked, what hasn't, and kind of going from there.
Yeah, Berent, how have you been doing these meetings, if at all, during COVID, when you're probably not getting together in person? Or maybe, I don't know, maybe you're staying 6 feet apart out in the farmland. I don't know.
Yep. Well, so for the most part, we didn't have a meeting for probably a good 3-4 months. And then here lately, we've just been having pretty much open air where we can kind of keep our social distance as best we can. Just kind of having some meetings, kind of out in the open air, nothing really enclosed. So it's kind of helped us, and it feels like a field trip. So we're able to get out and stretch our legs for sure.
Danny, Berent mentioned cover crops. What are some of the other regenerative agricultural approaches that people are talking about and swapping in these meetings?
Right. So there's folks that attend these meetings that have been farming for multi-generations, and some that are just trying to get established and determine where their place is in agriculture. So regenerative practices look different for everyone, right? Whether it might just be incorporating waterways, widening waterways, looking at taking some of the nominal farm ground out and making that into permanent pasture. And even sometimes it's kind of putting fence around some of our crop grounds so that allows us to plant cover crops and use them for late season grazing or spring grazing. It's really just kind of that shift in how we're using our land and, optimizing that for our land type, right? Everybody has a little bit different topography and soil. And so it's really kind of pairing our management a little bit closer to what's going to work well to take care of the soil, and that treats us well in return.
Berent, can you tell us a little bit about your own operation? What are you growing and or raising, and what kind of things have you been experimenting with?
For the most part, we've been slowly transitioning from dairy to crops. So basically right now on our farm, we mainly have corn and beans with a little bit of hay. And we're trying some different cover crop options. I think this year we're looking at a few different species mix. Slowly kind of getting into the cover crop game and seeing what we can do and what works well for us.
And we've mentioned cover crops a few times. Berent, can you tell us a little bit about, for the non-farmers listening, what are cover crops? What are their value for keeping the soil on the land there?
For the most part, and in our area, really rye is one of the few that are working so far. We're putting the rye down, or putting a crop down, just to kind of for that root structure to kind of hold the soil in place. Some guys are using that as forage later, but for the most part, just looking to hold the soil and hold the nutrients in the soil, so it's not running down and hitting Tainer Creek or further on down the line.
Danny, I know your eyes are on this watershed in particular with this group, but are you looking at this as a model for maybe other watersheds around the state or around the Midwest?
Right. So there's been a really good initiative by DATCAP to encourage more producer-led watershed groups throughout the state. And I think that's been very successful that way. And with our own organization, Valley Stewardship Network, we've been able to kind of use Tainer Creek as a little bit of a model to learn how to get this established, what works, what appeals to farmers. And the hope is that we can still continue to grow this amongst other watersheds that also feed into the Kickapoo and into our area here.
Berent, in our last half a minute or so, a farmer might be out there listening, thinking, wait a minute, I get to go to extra meetings? What? Can you give a little pep talk for people to try this, something like this, maybe in their own part of the state?
Well, I think the biggest thing is just kind of enjoying what you have around you. I know we're very proud of the Tainer Creek and of our natural beauty. So we like to see what we have, and we like to see it improved. So for the most part, just looking to preserve what we got and kind of move forward from there.
We'll leave it there. Berent, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thank you very much.
And Danny, thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank you.
We've been talking to Danny Heisler-Woodall and Berent Froiland. They're members of the Tainter Creek Farmer-Led Watershed Council in southwestern Wisconsin. They talked to us today about the ideas that farmers in the area are sharing and how they're working to protect their local waterways. Well, if you are involved in agriculture yourself, if you're a farmer or a local extension agent or involved in projects like this, want to hear what you are doing. Are you trying, experimenting with, as Barrett was, different cover crops to keep your soil on the land and to protect surrounding waterways? Or is there something else you're doing to try to protect water quality in your part of the state? Let us know. Send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. The state was scheduled to kick off this week. Unfortunately, it has been canceled. But as I've mentioned before, there are still ways to get the official state fair cream puffs. A drive-through curbside pickup starts this Thursday at the state fairgrounds, and some communities are going to get traveling cream puff sales during the course of August. You can find more info about that, how to get those puffs, at the Wisconsin State Fair website. But here's another option and a way to do some science learning at home, maybe with kids who are gearing up for science class next month. Make your own cream puffs at home with science. An organic chemist writing for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has a cream puff recipe up at the newspaper's website, jsonline.com. And there's some science advice thrown in to make sure that the cream puffs come out exactly the way you want them to, from keeping the whipped cream at the right chilly temperature, to making sure you get the right size air bubbles in the pastry, to the reason you poke a hole in the baked pastry to let out the steam. And of course, the importance of repeating that experiment again and again, just to make sure if you're getting it right. Of course, it won't be the same not getting them in the highly efficient cream puff line at the fair, not eating them in the middle of livestock shows, live music, maybe some carnival rides. You know, if you make or buy some cream puffs and you feel like it just isn't the same, feel free to send leftovers my way. I will find a good home for them. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.